This is 9/11 Freefall.
Gentlemen, welcome to another episode of 9/11 Freefall. My name is Andy Steele, and I am the host. Tonight, we'll be joined by Mick Harrison and John O'Kelly of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. They're going to be bringing some updates on the grand jury petition and the FBI lawsuit. This is very important stuff, so that's going to be coming your way in just a few minutes. Stay tuned.
How can such a publicly visible, easily measurable quantity be set aside?
Can you repeat the question, please?
Sure. How can such a publicly visible, easily measurable quantity be set aside?
Well, first of all, gravity is the loading function that applies to the structure, applies to all bodies on this planet, not just. In ground zero.
Yes, it was.
Floor by floor, instead of popping out.
It was if they had detonated.
Detonated.
They were planned to take down our building. Boom, 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 boom.
We have explosive demolition at not only the Twin Towers, but also Building 7.
For the third time today, it's reminiscent of those pictures we've all seen too much on television before when a building was deliberately destroyed by well-placed dynamite to knock it down.
You want to call your mother or something?
It's just a matter of time. That's all it is. It's a matter of time and the persistence of those who continue to adhere to it and push for it. And that's what we're doing.
Tune in to 9/11 Freefall, a show about 9/11 truth, 9/11 science, and the activists and scholars who are blowing the lid off the crime of the century. You can download episodes at 911freefall.com.
The views expressed on this show by guests and the host on issues outside of the 9/11 controlled demolition evidence are the opinions of those individuals alone and do not necessarily reflect those of architects and engineers for 9/11 truth.
I'm happy to be joined by my esteemed guest today. The first one is Mick Harrison. Mick is the Director of Litigation for the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. He is a public interest attorney. He's a graduate summa cum laude of the University of the District of Columbia School of Law. He has a national practice focused on cases that involve whistleblower protection, government accountability, corporate fraud, and false claims and dangers to public health or the environment. And we've been following him here all along on these two cases, and it's been a long struggle, but we are moving forward with it and just encountering everything that comes up in our path. And when I say we, I really mean they. I'm just bringing the news to you here. But Mick, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
And he is joined today by John O'Kelly, and John is a new board member for the Lawyers Committee, And I'm just meeting him here for the first time myself. So we're going to be getting to know John a little bit here at the beginning of this episode. So, John, thank you for stepping up and for your service to not just the 9/11 Truth community, but you're doing this for all of America, too. So thank you for that, and welcome to 9/11 Freefall.
It's great to be here. Great to be here. A little bit about myself. Do you want me to say anything?
Please, that was my first question. So please, tell us more about your background.
Well, I'm a New York attorney in Nassau County now, grew up in Queens, admitted to the bar for about 35 years, do defense and plaintiff's work in both commercial litigation and personal injury work, mostly in the New York City area. I followed 9/11 since the second it happened, was aware it wasn't what the government portrayed it as from the beginning, but haven't formally been involved except occasionally with AET 9/11 Truth on a couple of occasions with their petition drive in New York for the to put on the ballot the resolution to have a real investigation, which of course the courts threw out after invalidating the signatures. And I got re-involved here when I saw the Franklin Square resolution. Franklin Square is just a couple of neighborhoods away from mine. Happy to see it. Saw an opportunity. Maybe we can, you know, break the dam here. And got involved with the current petition in front of the Southern District.
That is amazing. And what's so amazing about it to me is it really proves that whole story or legend about the butterfly wings. You know, they say butterfly flapping its wings somewhere can cause a hurricane in another part of the world. Now, I don't know if that's scientifically accurate, but I understand the point it's trying to make is that one thing influences the other, and you have no idea who you're reaching out to when you talk about this evidence. And I was woken up because somebody decided to upload a video about 9/11 to a website, sort of like YouTube. I don't think it exists anymore. It obviously didn't survive the great battle for life here in the internet world. But somebody uploaded it at 2 in the morning. I came across this video thinking it was something else, and here I am. And because Chris Gioia led that effort at the Franklin Square and Munson Fire District, here you are, you're involved. So I want to say to other people, you know, put out your information, do your activism, even if you don't know who you're reaching out to, you could have a huge impact without even knowing it. So that is great for me to hear. It just proves that point. Well, John, I always ask this of every guest the first time they're on here. You know, where were you when you heard that we were under attack that day?
Oh, sure. I was home. We got a call from my sister telling us about the first plane that hit, turned on the television, saw the second plane that hit. And first plane hit, I thought, terrorism. Second plane that hit, I said, CIA. but my brother's with the fire department, so he was a chief. He retired as a chief recently, so we were concerned about where he was. I also had a sister who had her office in the South Tower. Luckily, she had just gotten off the bus for the Brooklyn Bridge when the second plane hit, so she wasn't up in her office at the time. They had a meeting, I think, at 9:45 this morning. She wasn't up there at the time, so luckily she was spared, although one of her colleagues did die who was up there at the time.
It's terrible, and especially in an area like New York City, and given the number of people that died there in the towers that day, it's like everybody knew somebody, even if it was sort of a twice removed situation. It could be an old college roommate or somebody they had worked with. So it really shows how this tragedy touched so many people. All right, so we're here for today for a reason, though, because there have been developments on both fronts. So we have the grand jury petition that was filed, and we also have the FBI lawsuit, both of which have been featured on this show. And every time there's a new development, we want to tell our supporters about it. So we bring Mick Harrison here and a member of the board for the Lawyers Committee to talk about it so that you guys are right here involved with what we're doing. When I say you guys, I'm talking to the audience because we want to be fully transparent and fully disclose what's happening with the lawsuits that you out there are helping to fund. So for the purpose of clarity here, we're going to take one and then we're going to go and talk about the other. We're going to start and talk for some time about the grand jury petition. Mick, in case there are newcomers to this movement, to the show, can you first remind our audience what the grand jury petition is all about and what action has been taken so far that's led us up to this point?
Right. So the Lawyers Committee prepared a 50-some page petition to the U.S. Attorney in the Southern District of New York, and that was filed back in July 2018, I believe. The purpose of that petition, which had attached to it a considerable amount of the scientific evidence that has been marshaled by architects and engineers and other independent scientists regarding the demolition of the Trade Center towers and Building 7 on 9/11, the purpose of that filing was to get the U.S. Attorney to relay all of that evidence to a federal special grand jury and to have the grand jury investigate for the first time this very persuasive and, as we would say, legally dispositive evidence of the use of explosives at the Trade Center on 9/11. And for those who have not heard this before and may not realize, there is a federal statute that mandates that a U.S. attorney anywhere receiving a report of a federal crime from a citizen must relay the information about that crime to a special grand jury. There's no specification about, you know, what happens next in the statute. It's going to be up to the other duties imposed on the grand jury to investigate crimes thoroughly and on the U.S. attorney to investigate and enforce federal crimes. But the key mandatory duty is the evidence must be handed over to the special grand jury to do with what it sees as appropriate. So the goal was pretty simple for this petition: get the evidence in the hands of 16 to 21 regular citizens assigned to a special grand jury with all the subpoena power, the power to possibly grant immunity, maybe through the U.S. Attorney's Office, to conduct investigations, bring witnesses in, acquire documents, even do, you know, if they choose, laboratory analysis and stuff like that. So we wanted to get that process started. We can't control where it goes, but we wanted to get it started. So somewhat to our surprise, after we filed that petition, but pleasant surprise it was, we heard back from the U.S. Attorney's Office in a letter, and one of the assistant U.S. attorneys there, Michael Ferrara, and another of his colleagues signed the letter, and they said, we received your submissions in July. I think April was the earlier one, which was the petition and the amended petition, and we will comply with the federal special grand jury statute regarding your submissions. And we took that to mean pretty much what it literally says, that the requirement in the special grand jury statute that the U.S. attorney, you know, hand over the evidence they were given about a federal crime to a grand jury, that they were actually going to do that in our case. And we took that as a positive development. But because we didn't hear anything further for a few months, we called the U.S. Attorney's Office, spoke with Mr. Ferrara, who was kind enough to take our call, and just ask him what the status was of our petition and whether the evidence had been given to the special grand jury. And he told us, unfortunately, that he didn't feel like he could tell us anything about the status because of this federal rule of criminal procedure, Rule 6, which imposes secrecy regarding grand jury proceedings to some extent. And there's a difference of opinion as to what extent. So Dave Weissmuck and I were talking with him and basically said, look, we're trying to avoid having to file a mandamus lawsuit in the federal court on this. Is there anything else you can tell us that might help us avoid filing that lawsuit? All we really want to know is that the grand jury has received the documents. And he said, no, I can't tell you anything further. So because of that, unfortunately, we were forced to file a federal lawsuit in the federal court in the Southern District of New York. And that's the lawsuit that John O'Kelly is helping us with. And we're very fortunate to have John as my co-counsel on that case. And that case has been pending now for a while. The purpose of it is pretty simple. There are two components. One is that we want a disclosure from the U.S. attorney, either to us or to the court, hopefully to the public, that our evidence has been given to the grand jury on the demolition of the Trade Center buildings on 9/11, or it has not. Either way, we want to know. And if the answer is the latter, that the evidence was not given to the grand jury, then the second part of our lawsuit would become active. Otherwise, it would be moot. But the second part is, if there has been no compliance with the grand jury statute by the U.S. attorney, then we want the court to order compliance, which means we want a court order requiring the U.S. attorney to hand our petition and the evidence we submitted to the special grand jury. So that's what that lawsuit is about. And if you're ready, I can tell you the status, but you may have some questions.
Not really. I just want everyone to have the background, because I'm aware that we're always taking in new people. So that is where we were at. So please share the new development with our audience.
All right. So, John, would you like to explain the sort of the procedural history, or shall I?
No, you can, Mick.
Okay. So the short version, Andy, is that once we filed the complaint, the mandamus complaint, in the Southern District of New York District Court, the government had 60 days to answer it. And normally what an answer is a paragraph-by-paragraph reply to each allegation in the complaint, either admitting or denying each allegation. However, in this case, instead of doing that, which I think would have served the public interest better, what the government in its wisdom chose to do was to file a letter brief, a letter motion with the local U.S. District Court judge asking for a conference according to local procedure before they file what they anticipate filing, which is a motion to dismiss our complaint on procedural grounds without getting to the merits of whether we're right or wrong about their duties and their compliance. So John and I have responded to the government's letter motion with a letter brief of our own. And so both sides have now put before the U.S. District Court the what I would call the gist of the government's anticipated argument that we lack standing to bring this suit, and that the statute that we're trying to enforce isn't really enforceable by citizens, and even if it was, there's no mandatory duty imposed on the government. So that's the short version of the government's position. And they took pains to say that they were not saying in their letter brief to the judge that they had not given our evidence to the grand jury, and they were not saying that they had. What they were saying was, we didn't have a right to find out, basically, through this lawsuit. So we responded and basically said the opposite, you know, that we have standing. There's actually a case in the Southern District of New York where someone did this before, and did a submission to a U.S. attorney of evidence they wanted given to a grand jury, and then that was not done. So that person sued, and the district court actually found in a very well analyzed decision that the citizen reporting the crime had standing to bring the lawsuit to enforce the duty to give the evidence to the grand jury. And so we explained this to the judge in our short letter brief, and that the law was enforceable by two different federal laws. One was the Administrative Procedures Act, which allows citizens to sue a federal agency that fails to perform a mandatory duty under law, or that unreasonably delay the action required of it under law. And we also sued under the Federal Mandamus Statute, which allows citizens to sue federal officials for failure to perform a mandatory duty. So the judge looked at both of the filings and then canceled the planned status conference. He didn't say why he canceled it, but my guess is he had his questions answered by the two written submissions. So he's now basically issued a briefing order, a briefing schedule. So the government is now planning to file its formal motion to dismiss in about 10 days from now. And the court gave us a fairly short time to respond, only 7 days. And I think the reason for that short time frame was that we told the court we anticipated filing an amended complaint after the motion to dismiss is filed, which is our right under the federal rules of procedure. And that would add we hope, new plaintiffs, including maybe one or more 9/11 family members. We're actually hoping that architects and engineers will join us in that lawsuit. Currently, Richard Gage is already a plaintiff, co-plaintiff, but we're hoping AE would consider as an organization. And then we're going to beef up our standing allegations, probably submit some standing affidavits to support our position more clearly for the judge's benefit, and articulate as clearly as we can our legal claims. So once we file that amended complaint, it essentially moots the motion to dismiss that the government will have by that time already filed, because we have a right to amend and the amendment replaces the original. And so because the government's first motion was targeted to the original complaint, it now becomes moot, and the government has to refile a new motion if it chooses. And it doesn't have to do this, but, you know, we predict they probably will. But once they read our amended complaint, if they still find in their own mind that their standing and other arguments are correct, they'll probably just refile their motion to dismiss. At that point, we'll file our opposition, and eventually we'll get a decision from the Southern District of New York District Court on whether we have a right to proceed with this lawsuit or not. If we do have that right, it will get very interesting pretty quick, because the government will have to respond to the merits of our allegations about their duty to give the evidence to the grand jury and whether they have done so or not, which is something they don't seem to want to disclose. And if the district court decides we don't have the right to pursue this lawsuit, we will then bring an appeal to the Second Circuit, U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, and see if the Court of Appeals can establish our right to proceed. So that's sort of where that case is standing at the moment.
Now, I just want to clarify for our audience, because there's a lot of talk and legalese and all of this, and it can get a little bit confusing. This is only in regard to the mandamus lawsuit. The grand jury petition itself has not been thrown out. This is just regarding your attempt to make the U.S. Attorney's Office disclose whether or not they're actually doing anything with it. Is that correct?
It's precisely correct. It's a good point. Whether or not we have a right to bring the mandamus lawsuit to find out the status of the grand jury proceeding, the grand jury proceeding has already been initiated by our initial petition. So it could be going full speed ahead as far as we know. Unfortunately, we don't know. But whether it is or it isn't, our right to submit the evidence is, I don't think anyone disputes that, even the government. Their only argument is, what are they obligated to do once we submit it? And so we don't know whether that grand jury process is proceeding. But even if we were to lose the mandamus lawsuit, which I think is the point of your clarification, that grand jury petition will still go wherever it's going to go.
All right, so that's, I just want to get that established with the audience. This is just you guys trying to compel the U.S. attorney to tell you what's going on with it. And it's not like you're demanding to be right there in the room as they present the petition. We just want to know if they're doing their job, if they're following what they said they were going to do in that initial letter. Now, and either of you feel free to chime in on this question, but what are some of the grounds that the U.S. attorney is arguing against this mandamus suit? And in particular, I want to hear from you guys. What's your response to it?
Okay, John, you want to pick your favorite?
Well, it's going to primarily be the standing argument, that the argument is that the organization really, I think they don't look at the organization as a person with a concrete of enough interest in the case to bring the suit. And, you know, standing is, it's at this point, it's a weaponized doctrine as far as I'm concerned. If you're favored, they find you have standing. If you're not favored, you don't have standing. Or for policy reasons, the courts, you know, they're not looking for more business. They have too many cases as it is. So one way to limit the number of cases is to find lack of standing in certain instances for policy reasons. And I think this is one of those areas, because they fear that if they open the doors to allowing us to bring this, the grand jury petition, and to force it, you know, to force it to be heard, you'll have lots of plaintiffs doing the same, kind of similar to the RICO statutes, which the Second Circuit always discourages to, you know, to the utmost extent. So it's a standing issue. And in order to deal with that, our best arguments for standing will be more plaintiffs who were either directly injured or whose family members were killed in the attacks. I mean, that would put it as squarely, you know, that would be our strongest case. So if there are family members out there, or if there are, you know, persons who were injured, and there still are, there are lots of firemen who are still coming down, and lots of other people still coming down with cancers and different injuries at this point, some of whom only have found out in the last few years. Those people couldn't be our plaintiffs. But it's going to be standing, I think, is the primary argument. That's the battlefield.
Just to add a little bit to what John is saying about the standing, and then there are a couple other points you may want to know about in terms of the government's arguments, which are not as central as the standing argument. But for those who haven't been to law school and are wondering what this whole standing controversy is about, the short version is the Constitution gives the courts the right to decide what are called cases and controversies. And the Supreme Court over the years has determined that that means real disputes between real people about things that matter. And they've unpacked that over the years and unfortunately becoming more and more demanding in terms of, you know, who has the sort of the type of case that the courts have the power to decide. In other words, who has standing to walk into the court with their dispute. And they're basically saying that you have to be adversely affected in some way by what you're complaining about. For example, if you're complaining about a violation of a federal statute, which we are, that, you know, it was a sort of statute that Congress intended to benefit you and that you've been harmed in some way by the noncompliance. So if the courts find that you have been harmed and you fall into the zone that Congress intended folks to be protected by the statute, then they're going to let you proceed with your lawsuit, find that you have standing. And if they find that you haven't been harmed in any legally recognizable way, or that you don't fall into the group that Congress intended to protect with the statute, then the courts are going to say you don't have standing, and it's not the type of case that they have the power to hear. So that's what underlies this whole thing. But as John points out, the case law has developed over the last several decades to be more and more restrictive of citizens' right to sue. You see a lot of environmental suits dismissed for lack of standing, suits by nonprofits, and so forth. So, it, you know, in my view, I agree with John that the doctrine has been overly, it's been developed in an overly restrictive manner, and it's basically, you know, keeping citizens from what I would call seeking redress for government wrongs through the courts, and I think that's actually contrary to the Constitution. And one of these days, you know, that whole thing may come to another decision by the Supreme Court and hopefully open back up the courts more to citizens. In the meantime, we're dealing with law as it exists. Now, in addition to the standing argument, the government is claiming that we don't have a right to enforce the special grand jury statute because it isn't one of those statutes that creates or implies a right to sue. And the problem with the government's argument on that is that we have two other statutes that give us the right to sue. In this case, I mentioned them, the Administrative Procedures Act and the Mandamus Statute. So the government's pretty much dead wrong on that. And then they also argue somewhat mysteriously that the grand jury statute doesn't actually impose a mandatory duty on the U.S. attorney to give citizen-reported evidence to a grand jury. Pretty much every court that's looked at it, maybe a couple exceptions, but the Second Circuit, I think, is one, and the D.C. Circuit is another, and the Southern District of New York itself has looked at it, and they've all said, yes, the duty is mandatory on the U.S. attorney to relay the evidence to the grand jury. The only question is, you know, who has the right to enforce the statute if they don't? So that's the short version of what the government is arguing.
It's fascinating to me when you dive into the legal talk and looking at how they try to dismiss this based on the standing issue. I mean, to an ordinary citizen, it's like we've all been adversely affected by September 11th. I know things aren't that simple when you step into a courtroom. but it's just hard to believe that you could have a situation where you have so much corruption going on, and you can see it on television with the media, you can see it with the politicians who refuse to do anything, that there is no recourse if all of the institutions are so corrupted that you can't go through the FBI to try to get justice on this. You can't go through Congress. That there isn't something for people to bring new evidence someone might have about a matter so big as this. Now, why do you believe that we do have standing? What is your argument?
Well, it's pretty straightforward. I would encourage you to read this district court decision from the Southern District of New York. And it basically said, and went through history, of the special grand jury statute, which imposes this duty on the U.S. attorney. And there is, you know, a clear history of what Congress intended when they passed this statute. It was already sort of the default in terms of citizens trying to force a prosecutor to do something that, as a general rule, federal prosecutors have discretion as to whether they enforce a given law and how they enforce it and when they enforce it, whether that's good for the public interest or not. Is another question, but that has been the law. But when Congress passed the special grand jury statute, it made clear that it wanted to remove the discretion of the U.S. attorney on this particular action of when a citizen reports a crime, handing the information over to a special grand jury. And the Southern District of New York got it right in their decision in this case called Henry's special grand jury. That, and I think it was like back in 1982, 1986, something like that, they decided this. And they said it's clear that, you know, the statute imposes a duty. It's clear that Congress intended to remove the discretion of the government. It's clear that that duty creates a right that runs to the citizen plaintiff who reports the crime, and that they have a right and standing to enforce when the duty is not honored. And the case goes into actually a more persuasive analysis than what I just said, and it's, I believe, entirely correct. So we've basically adopted the rationale that this particular court has made explicit in a decision, you know, 20-some years ago, which we believe is correctly decided. And as you said, you know, almost everybody has had some kind of adverse impact from 9/11. But as John says, you know, family members of victims have special egregious impacts, which should give them standing. And we think that the Lawyers Committee and architects and engineers have sort of unique organizational interest in this issue as nonprofits trying to bring the truth out and trying to get some transparency and accountability on the issue, that we also would have standing because of our special organizational interests that are adversely affected by the secrecy. So that's the short version. I don't know, John, do you want to add anything to our standing position?
No, only I just want to make a comment on what Andy had said earlier about with this increase in corruption. We have an inverse relationship now on standing. The more corruption, the less standing we find we get, and it's when we need it more. And there's a reason for that, the corruption. The corruption goes hand in hand with the constriction on our rights to seek redress. I think it's political, and just the with regard to the standing issue, I don't, and Mick can tell us more about it. But he mentioned before we'll appeal if we're denied. And it'll put the issue squarely before the Second Circuit, and that could be interesting.
Yes, it will be. And I just want to go back to this because I sort of have forgotten now, but wasn't there a time period by which the U.S. Attorney's Office has to do this, has to submit this to the grand jury? When was that time frame, and how close are we to it?
There is no statutory deadline for the U.S. Attorney doing his or her job and submitting citizen-reported evidence of a federal crime to the grand jury, which I think the law would say then implicitly creates a sort of a, quote, reasonable time, unquote, deadline. It's not a, like, certain number of months or certain number of days or something like that. It's mandatory that it be done. And under the Administrative Procedures Act, if there is a statutory requirement or duty and it's not honored in the short term, basically, you can sue a government agency or official for what's called agency action unreasonably denied or delayed? And then the courts have to decide the answer to your question, which is, what is an unreasonable delay?
Well, it just seems so odd to me that they can just put this into a black hole and give you no word on what's happening with it. And now it's becoming an issue because of the mandamus suit. So the pressure is on them, and the 9/11 Truth Movement is watching. Anybody interested in this issue is watching them. I don't think they can just get away with sticking it in a file somewhere and hoping that it goes away. I mean, the people will know about this. So you're doing everything that you can do with it, and we expected these kinds of things to happen because obviously the issue is what it is, the situation is what it is, and they're going to try to challenge us on every level that they can. So it's going to be a long fight. I think you alluded to this before, but I want our audience to take note of it. They're always waiting for the next big step. What is the next big thing we have to wait for?
On the mandamus or the grand jury petition?
Well, on the mandamus, since we're talking about that.
Well, the next big step would be the government's motion to dismiss, as I said, due in about 10 days. And then the second big step would be our amended complaint. Third big step would be the government's renewed motion to dismiss, or it would be an even bigger step if they said, oh, we read the amended complaint, we actually agree with the plaintiffs, we have a right to proceed. So we're going to file a substantive answer to the complaint, and that would be a big step. I wouldn't hold my breath waiting on it, but I hope that it happens.
Well, we're going to follow it, and we'll be letting our supporters know as soon as anything significant happens. Again, it takes a long time sometimes for these things to come forward. So when we know something, then you will know something. Now, I want to make sure we cover the FBI lawsuit because it's just as important here.
Hey, Andy, sorry to interrupt. Before you go to the FBI lawsuit, there's one other twist and turn on the grand jury petition and mandamus that you might want to know about or your listeners might want to know about. It's one of our arguments more than one of the government's arguments, so that they responded. There's a category of records related to the grand jury proceedings that we call ministerial, and these are not the transcripts of witness testimony or copies of exhibits actually handed to the grand jury while they're looking at evidence. So it's not proceedings directly occurring before the grand jurors. But ministerial records have to do with sort of the business of getting the grand jury up and running and how it proceeds. And there is case law in some circuits, at least, that ministerial records don't fall under the Rule 6 secrecy requirement, or if they do, they're available to the public in a much more relaxed standard in terms of showing a need for the records, because they don't really disclose evidence being given to the grand jury, testimony or exhibits, and they can be easily redacted to take out the names of either witnesses or grand jurors. So there's no real risk of harm from the release of those types of ministerial records, like let's say there was a notice sent to the grand jurors or their appointment, or a notice of the convening of the first grand jury meeting, maybe an agenda to be addressed, things like that. So we've asked in our motion for disclosure, which is part of the mandamus petition, to be given at least enough of the ministerial records just to let us know whether, the grand jury is looking at our petition. And, even if they just gave us that, it basically would moot the entire lawsuit, because that's all we're trying to find out. Did they do their job and give this to the grand jury? So I just want you to know that the government is trying to argue, and they don't have very good authority for this, that the ministerial record should be just as secret as, testimony before the grand jury. And I don't expect the courts to agree with that. We'll have to wait and see.
It doesn't surprise me that they're being so secretive about what's happening, because they probably are hoping that it will go away. All right, so on to the FBI lawsuit. First, Mick, same as before, can you just give the background on what this is about and then give us the new update?
The lawsuit began because there was another mandate from Congress back in 2013-2014 to the FBI in this case, and the FBI was mandated by Congress to do a new independent evaluation related to 9/11, and they were required to do several things in this congressional mandate, which was made part of an appropriations bill by Congress, but still enforceable in our view, and still imposes duties on the FBI, just as in a regular law that becomes a statute. So the requirements of the new mandate from Congress were that the FBI look at and evaluate how well the FBI was doing in terms of implementing the recommendations from the original 9/11 Commission back in 2004, but also to evaluate all evidence related to 9/11 that had not been assessed by the original 9/11 Commission. And what the FBI did in response to this mandate was create what they called the 9/11 Review Commission. Some folks don't even know that that commission was created in 2014, but it was headed by a small panel of folks appointed by the DOJ, one of whom was the chair was Ed Meese, former Attorney General, as I recall. And they did issue a report in 2015 in March, this new 9/11 Review Commission, and they purported, at least, to address the congressional mandate that they look at all new 9/11 evidence. The problem is that they didn't do that. In fact, they looked at very little that could be described as new 9/11 evidence, and they ignored the entire body of the evidence of demolition, use of explosives at the Trade Center on 9/11. They ignored the evidence regarding the high fivers that were arrested celebrating the 9/11 attacks on the morning of 9/11. They ignored the evidence of videos from the Pentagon that have yet to be released. They ignored evidence of the Saudi financing and other international financing of the latest hijackers and other aspects of the terrorist acts of 9/11. They ignored the evidence of plane parts recovered at the crime scenes and what those parts showed. And they ignored a couple of the categories of evidence. So because this duty, in our view, was another of these mandatory duties, it wasn't within the discretion of the FBI to just thumb their nose at Congress on this. And because they didn't honor the duty, they didn't comply, we decided to sue them, again, under the Administrative Procedures Act and the federal mandamus statute. And we did that. That complaint was then the subject of a somewhat predictable government motion to dismiss on similar grounds that we were talking about for the mandamus case. The government asked the case to be dismissed on standing and that the statute in question was not enforceable. We briefed that and made our arguments to the contrary. The district court unfortunately agreed with the government on the standing question and decided that we being the Lawyers Committee and architects and engineers, and Bob McElvain, the father of Bobby McElvain, who was killed at the Trade Center on 9/11, that none of us had standing to require the FBI to comply with this congressional mandate. And so where that leaves us is appealing to the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, because this suit was brought in the district court in D.C., and our deadline for filing our notice of appeal on that case to ask the Court of Appeals to reverse the district court's decision is coming up, and that's around March the 3rd. So that's sort of where that case stands, and we do intend to appeal.
How does Bob McElvain not have standing? A guy who lost his son that day. It just baffles me that 9/11 victims' family members don't have a right to compel the FBI to look at reasonable evidence, which is, again, this is reasonable evidence. And if they don't believe it's reasonable, then they need to make the case for why they don't believe it's reasonable, which I don't believe they've done. You can correct me if I'm wrong. I just want to hear from both of you. I mean, what do you think about what I just said?
Yeah, well, this goes to, you know, and Bob McElvain, it's a great point. How much closer can you get? And what the government might argue, and this is why, again, I'm going to harp on getting more plaintiffs in our case. They might, for instance, argue that the son was over the age of 18, so he's emancipated, or he wasn't living there, so he's not. So they're not, you know, endowed with the right to bring this suit on their behalf. It just goes to show the extent that they will carry this argument unless they are absolutely pinned in a corner with nowhere to turn. That's why it's just so important that we get as many people with as direct injuries and as direct injuries as is possible, so that they can't slither out, and we can then put it before, if we get dismissed in a district court, to a circuit court, and put it squarely before them.
I just want to add my two cents on your question about the dismissal of the FBI lawsuit on the standing question. I find it offensive that the court found that Bob McElvain did not have standing. I think it was wrong to find that Architects and Engineers and Lawyers Committee did not have standing, but I'm not as offended by that. But I am offended that the court would say that a family member who'd lost a family member at 9/11 did not have standing to enforce the requirement that the FBI look at all the evidence regarding the event that caused the death of that family member. So I think that's just dead wrong. One of the arguments the government made was that, and that the court relied on, was that in their view, it wasn't clear that, and I think the court just made a mistake on this, that there was no reporting requirement involved in this law, that it was just a law to assess the evidence and not a requirement to report back to Congress on what they found in assessing the evidence, which to me would be kind of dumb for Congress to spend $2 million for a study and then never get a chance to see the results. But that's basically what the court said, that there was no reporting requirement. And if there was no reporting requirement to tell anybody, including Congress, the results, then we, the plaintiffs, were also not intended to receive those results and be the beneficiaries of that information. It's sort of what we call an informational standing argument. And the court is wrong on that. The Congress has made clear more than once that they want maximum transparency with the public on the facts regarding 9/11, and they want the family members to know as much as can be told regarding what happened on 9/11. And so there's no real doubt that Congress, had they received this report from the FBI, and by the way, they did receive it, it was actually reported to them. The court is just saying, I guess, that they didn't have to, but they chose to report it to Congress, which is, you know, contrary to what the law says. But so, you know, it's clear that there was a reporting requirement. There's a special statement from the Senate Intelligence Committee, Appropriations Committee chair, I believe, at the time, which basically laid out what Congress expected from this law, where they tasked the FBI to do the study, and it was very explicit in saying that the FBI will report back on its findings after assessing all this evidence independently to Congress. And the entire Congress actually voted in approving the bill on a statement that said that statement, that clarification statement by the senator, would be treated as if it were a joint statement of a committee of conference, which means both houses saying, here's what we think this law requires, which is as dispositive of evidence on legislative intent by the Congress as you can find. So, you know, there's a lot, and I guess I should add that this isn't just our view about what Congress intended. The actual report from the Ed Meese 9/11 Review Commission, in the beginning when they describe how they came to exist and what their task was, they basically say, we had a mandate from Congress, the FBI had a mandate from Congress to do this assessment and report it back to Congress. So they, even the FBI and its new commission, read the law the same as we now read it. They read it right at the time, but after we sued them, they suddenly had a different view of the law.
Seems pretty contradictory to me that we have a mandate to do this work and report back to Congress, and then they say that they don't have to, that any reporting that they did is voluntary. It makes you wonder who is really running the country, and it also makes you wonder, what does the law actually mean anymore if they can just deny what is right in front of them? If you can wear a red shirt and somebody tells you that it's blue. You know, I've seen joke skits on comedy shows where people are in court and someone says, you were standing there with a knife in your hand, and he says, no, I wasn't. And it becomes a whole routine, and it's supposed to be a joke, but I mean, in this case, it almost sounds very similar. We're mandated, we're not mandated. It depends on who's asking. And of course, the people that are asking are not just architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, not just the lawyers committee, but it's the family members, it's Americans, concerned people who have no reason to pursue this other than for the sake of justice and wanting to see justice done for those we lost on that day. So I think it's just absolutely disgusting what you guys are having to go through on the road to pursuing this. Same question as before in the grand jury petition. What's the next big step that our supporters can look forward to in this? You may have said it, but I just want to highlight it here for them.
Yeah, that's no problem. Next step would be our notice of appeal, which will be around March the 3rd. And then the court will set there are some preliminary papers that have to be filed, which I wouldn't call a big step. But the next big step after that would be the actual appellate briefs, where you lay out your arguments to the Court of Appeals, and that schedule normally gives you about 30 days for the plaintiffs and the appellants, which would be us, to file the first brief. And that 30 days will probably start counting after all the preliminary paperwork is filed. So I'm guessing, and it is a bit of a guess, we're probably talking about mid to late April for our appellate brief, where, and of course we'll post it, but you know, our arguments will be laid out about why the district court was wrong in dismissing our FBI lawsuit.
Now, let's focus on what is out there among the supporters, because we get a lot of questions about these two court cases, the grand jury petition and the FBI lawsuit. And, you know, sometimes there's just nothing happening because it takes time for these things to move forward. So I say be patient and not get frustrated. So I want to hear from both of you, why is it so important to keep on pursuing this, even though we can see there's a lack of will, obviously, from the institutions we're trying to appeal to? Why is it so important to keep on knocking on the door and expecting them to answer, even if they keep on trying to close it? We'll start with John.
Well, for one thing, and we are developing new information all the time, and I can tell you, and although we may not be able to talk about what we're doing, and I think Mick will second it, that we're very actively looking at new information right now in different aspects of these cases, you know, the underlying events, that maybe helps push us over the top, all right? That maybe helps gain some additional momentum, either political or legal momentum. So that's one reason. And people keep coming on board or come forward. They'll hear something, somebody make a contact, leads to something else, leads to something else. So the dam may break, you know, and just in general, people across the country in lots of different areas are seeing a lot of this corruption, a lot of this dishonesty in a lot of different areas, and there is a certain momentum building underneath. How's it going to play out with this? I don't know, but I think it is. It's there.
Mick, same question.
Well, I agree with what John said, and then as an additional answer, there's this old saying that persistence is the key, or the alternative version, never give up. There's a reason why those old sayings are old sayings, and that is there's a lot of truth in them. I can tell you from my own experience, I had a whistleblower case where my colleagues and I at Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility represented the first female chief of the U.S. Park Police, Teresa Chambers. And she had disclosed to the Washington Post that the Bush administration was not funding the U.S. Park Police sufficient to protect either citizens in the parks or to protect national monuments, including from terrorism. And she was promptly fired for having basically had the courage to say something critical about the Bush administration in public. So we represented her and sued on her behalf under the federal whistleblower protections. And we lost the first round at a administrative judge level with the Merit System Protection Board. And we lost, I believe we lost, it's been a while now, which is the point of the story, that it's been a while. We lost, I think, at the second level, the Merit System Protection Board. Then we won at the third level, which was the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. And then we ended up winning back at the Merit System Protection Board. So that whole process took 7 to 10 years to get her reinstated into her job, which she was, as the first female chief of the U.S. Park Police. And if, had we not been persistent, and in particular had she not been persistent, you know, she would not have prevailed. Now, I had another case, very similar, senior scientist at US EPA who had actually blown the whistle on the dangers from the World Trade Center dust after the buildings collapsed on 9/11, and we now know just how dangerous that was with all the folks who have unfortunately been getting sick and dying years and years after. So she reported to Congress and the FBI, and of course they promptly fired her. It took us, I think, about 7 years to actually get her reinstated through various levels of litigation, and we did, and we won, but if we had not been persistent, we wouldn't have gotten there. So, you know, I think, I don't know if I want to tell folks to be patient or not be frustrated. I think all of us probably have a right to be frustrated at the moment, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't still be persistent.
Right. I think it's great to be frustrated. Just, it needs to be directed at the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI, not at the people who are fighting hard here to get the justice done. And I agree with you. Persistence is so important, and nothing has ever been accomplished without persistence. And there's a quote out there, and I can't remember the exact wording of it, but it says, you know, talent is not that big of a deal. It's the persistence that really pays off, and those are the people that are successful in any endeavor. Guys, we're going to keep on following this, and we give you the highest praise for taking on this mission. For years, we waited for a lawyers group to come along and do this, do the work that you are doing, and now you're here. So thank you so much, and thank you for coming on 9/11 Free Fall today.
Thank you, Andy.
This program is on every Thursday night on No Lies Radio at 10 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Pacific, and every other Sunday night on BBS Radio at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. You can also keep track of the archives by going to 911freefall.com. This is Andy Steele. Thank you for a great week. Good luck.